Today is Wednesday, November the 17th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Watch out, Chrome OS! Microsoft's low-cost Surface Windows Laptop SE is a new Chromebook competitor. Microsoft has struggled to understand why schools and students have flocked to Chromebooks. The company tried an S-mode previously that essentially locked Windows 10 down to apps from the Microsoft Store. The restriction was more of an irritation for end users and schools, as there weren't enough apps available in the Microsoft Store to make sense. Microsoft is going head-to-head with Chromebooks now with a new $249 Surface Laptop SE, its most affordable Surface yet. While the software giant has attempted to compete with the popularity of Chrome OS in U.S. schools for years, the Surface Laptop SE is the company's first true Chromebook competitor. Microsoft has created a new edition of Windows 11 designed for students and schools. Windows 11 SE will ship exclusively on low-cost laptops that are built for K-A classrooms, and it marks another attempt by Microsoft to take on Google's range of Chromebooks and their popularity in U.S. schools. Windows 11 SE takes a different approach to a Windows edition for schools, and it's a similar direction where Microsoft was originally heading with Windows 10X before its cancellation. Windows 11 SE will only be available on new low-cost and only for education customers. While Windows 11 SE is naturally optimized for Microsoft Edge, Office, and Microsoft cloud-based services, it's not restricted to just Microsoft apps. Windows 11 SE also supports third-party apps, including Zoom and Chrome, because they want to give schools a choice to use what works best for them. IT admins will be in charge of what apps gets installed, and devices can be managed to silently update outside of class time. Windows 11 SE won't ship with the Microsoft Store. Instead, Microsoft is allowing certain third-party apps for IT admins to provision on SE devices. That list of apps includes Chrome and Zoom right now, but Microsoft hasn't shared its final list of approved apps just yet. Most of the Windows 11 SE changes are fairly minor. Microsoft has spent the past 18 months talking to teachers and students to get feedback on its efforts to date on low-cost Windows laptops. That feedback has led to apps always launching in full-screen mode on Windows 11 SE. And Microsoft has removed the multiple snap layouts in this edition in favor of a single mode that lets you place apps side by side. The new widgets section of Windows 11 has also been removed in SE, as Microsoft found it's distracting in a classroom environment. Microsoft Edge will also be configured to accept Chrome extensions, which is turned off by default on Windows 11. Many schools in the United States rely on Chrome extensions as part of their Chrome OS usage, so this change is a clear recognition of that. Windows 11 SE also backs up documents to OneDrive by default, with offline support to make it easier for students to use these Windows 11 SE laptops beyond just the classroom. Windows 11 SE will also ship with a new colorful Bloom wallpaper by default and some changes to the way apps are bundled. While you might experience having two different versions of OneNote or Teams in Windows 11, Microsoft is cleaning this up in Windows 11 SE, so only a single version is installed. Surface Laptop SE will be sold exclusively to schools and students, starting at $249. It's part of a much broader effort with Windows 11 SE, a new student edition designed to compete with Chrome OS that will ship on a range of low-cost laptops in the coming months. The Surface Laptop SE is all plastic. Surface Laptop SE is a low-cost Windows device which retains the same keyboard and trackpad function found on Microsoft's Surface Laptop Go. The all-plastic body houses an 11.6-inch display running at just at 1366 by 768 resolution. This is a 16:9 ratio Surface device. The screen low-resolution screen is a head-scratcher as far as I'm concerned, since the Lenovo Chromebook Duet ships with a better 10.1-inch 1920 by 1200 display for the same price as the Surface Laptop SE. Intel Celeron N4020 or the Celeron N4120, the Surface Laptop SE combined with 4 GB or 8 GB of RAM and 64 GB or 128 GB of eMMC storage. Microsoft is including a 1-megapixel front-facing camera that offers 720p support, and the Surface Laptop SE also includes a single USB A port, 1 USB C port, a regular barrel type C connector, and a 3.5mm headphone jack. That means this Surface model ships without Microsoft's magnetic Surface charging port. Microsoft is committing to a big repairability effort with the Surface Laptop SE, allowing screws to replace components inside the laptop. The base of the Surface Laptop SE has standard screws that will allow IT admins to replace the display, battery, keyboard, and even the motherboard. Microsoft has spent the past 18 months talking to IT admins about the pain points of managing laptops and screws, and repairability was one of the top concerns. Microsoft will sell spare parts through its authorized service providers, and it should mean screws can replace components on-site instead of having to send devices for repair and wait days or weeks for them to be fixed. Let's hope we see similar repairability in other Surface laptops in the future, as Microsoft has committed to make its devices easier to repair by the end of 2022. Microsoft is launching the Surface Laptop SE in early 2022 in the United States, UK, Canada, and Japan. A range of Windows 11 SE laptops will also be available from Acer, Asus, Dell, Dynabook, Fujitsu, HP, Lenovo, and Positivo. Microsoft is also bundling apps like Teams, Office, OneNote, Minecraft for education, and Flipgrid in Windows 11 SE so IT admins don't have to install them separately. This should make it easier for students to simply open up a Windows 11 SE laptop, type their login information, and instantly get access to their apps and cloud documents. Will Microsoft be a strong competitor against Google in the education field? We'll find out. The chip shortage with older process technology. It turns out there is plenty of demand for chips made using older process technology. Why it matters? According to the Semiconductor Industry Association, global chip sales grew 28% in the third quarter to $144.8 billion. There are no signs of this growth slowing down in the foreseeable future, but a particularly interesting side effect is that companies that build chips on older process technology have found themselves in a position of power where they can pick and choose their customers based on who they think will make a great long-term partner. By now, everyone is familiar with the ongoing chip shortage and how it affects almost everything that's powered by electronics. The auto industry has seen the biggest impact from this crisis, and analysts expect it would lead to a $210 billion loss by the end of this year. As for when we can expect things to improve, the most optimistic forecast is that supply will catch up with demand sometime in the second half of 2022. Realistically, it will extend well into 2023. Beyond this supply crunch, certain companies have previously operated in the shadow of giants like Taiwan Semiconductor, Samsung, and Intel are now coming into focus thanks to their ability to quickly adapt their business practices to the rapidly changing semiconductor landscape. One such company is Microchip, which is known for making microcontrollers that add low-power computing capabilities to cars, home appliances, security systems, medical devices, industrial equipment, and more. In fact, the devices you're using right now have several of these chips that are dedicated to small tasks such as power management, reading data from sensors, translating input from a touch digitizer or keyboard, mouse and trackpad, and more. This year, demand for Microchip's products soared so high that it has trouble keeping up. The Chandler, Arizona-based company can only satisfy two-thirds of that demand, and this situation is a result of a specific business decision made earlier this year. Microchip used to let customers cancel a chip order within 90 days of delivery, but this year it started prioritizing clients that signed contracts for 12 months or more of orders that couldn't be canceled or rescheduled. Interestingly, this strategy worked so well that clients flocked to Microchip, and now the company is able to forge ahead with investments in added manufacturing capacity, guided by a constant feedback loop from customers that are acting more like partners. Without commitment for older technology chips, there is no incentive for any company to expand plant investment. Other lesser-known chip makers like ST Microelectronics, onsemi, Infineon, and NXP Semiconductors have seen a similar increase in demand for their products, which are being manufactured on mature process nodes using aging equipment. Companies like Intel have offered to help automakers and other clients move to newer process nodes, but we have yet to see any development in that direction. Car companies are reluctant to make such a move due to reliability and cost concerns, as the systems they build need to perform well in a wide range of situations, regardless of temperature, vibration, humidity, and road debris. This is why they prefer older technology that's already proven and it can stand the test of time. Going with a new technology can also have a domino effect on the design of the cars, which would need to be adapted to work with more advanced chips. It's something to say that old technology is like a pair of old shoes. It wears well. Shortages in the chip industry are not transitory. The semiconductor industry lives at the cutting edge of technological progress. So why can't it produce enough chips to keep the world moving? Nearly 2 years ago, into pandemic-caused disruptions, a severe shortage of computer chips, the components at the heart of smartphones, laptops, and innumerable other products, continues to affect manufacturers across the global economy. Automakers have been forced to halt production in recent months as sales decline because they can't make enough cars. The shortage has affected industries from game consoles and networking gear to medical devices. In October, Apple blamed chip scarcity for crimping its financial results, and Intel warned that the drought will likely stretch to 2023. The semiconductor supply chain has become stretched in new ways that are deeply rooted and difficult to resolve. Demand is ballooning faster than chip makers can respond, especially for basic yet widespread components that are subject to the kind of big variations in demand that make investments risky. It is utterly amazing that it's taken so long for the supply chain to rebound after the global economy came to a halt during COVID. For one thing, the sheer scale of demand has been surprising. In 2020, as COVID began upending business as usual, the chip industry was already expecting an upswing. Worldwide chip sales fell 12% in 2019, and according to the Semiconductor Industry Association. But in December 2019, the group predicted that global sales would grow 5.9% in 2020 and 6.3% in 2021. Boy, did they get it wrong. In fact, the latest figures show that demand, that sales grew 29.7% between August 2020 and August 2021. Demand is being driven by technologies like cloud computing and 5G, along with growing use of chips in all manner of products, from cars to home appliances. At the same time, U.S. imposed sanctions on Chinese companies like Huawei, a leading manufacturer of smartphones and networking gear, prompted some Chinese firms to begin hoarding as much supply as possible. The surge in demand for high-tech products triggered by working from home, the lockdown, and a shift to e-commerce has only continued, taking many by surprise. Chip makers didn't appreciate the extent of the sustained demand until about a year ago, but they can't turn on a dime. New chip-making factories cost billions of dollars and take years to build and outfit. It takes about 2 years to build a new factory. Factories have gotten a lot bigger, a lot more expensive, and a lot more complicated to build. This past week, Sony and Taiwan Semiconductor, the world's largest contract maker of chips, said they would invest $7 billion to build a fab capable of producing older components, but it won't start making chips until the end of 2024. Intel is also investing in several cutting-edge new fabs, but those won't come online until 2024. And only one company, ASML of the Netherlands, make the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines needed for cutting-edge chip making, and ASML can't produce machines quickly enough to satisfy demand. Another issue is that not all chips are created equal. Simple components, power control integrated circuits, microcontrollers, and sensors have become key components. These devices are far simpler than CPUs and graphic processing units used in smartphones and game machines, and are made using older manufacturing methods that require less complexity. But they're in just about every electronic product, from microwave ovens to medical devices and toys. A power controlling integrated circuit used in many products that once cost $1 can sell for as much as $150. Lead times for such components have stretched from 4 to 8 weeks to 24 to 52 weeks. Shortages of these devices are boosting demand for hard-to-find older chip-making equipment. Gartner estimates that semiconductor foundries operated at 95.6% of their capacity in the second quarter of 2021, compared with 76.5% in the second quarter of 2019. This effectively means that plants are maxed out because some downtime is needed for maintenance. Global Foundries said in October that the company was sold out through 2023. The CFO of Analog Devices, which makes some of the components in greatest demand, told investors in August that his company's order book at the time stretched into its next fiscal year, which began this month. Parts of the challenge for chip makers is that some customers may be double ordering or buying more components than they need in case supplies dries up, distorting the picture of future demand. It's spot shortages fueled by double ordering that's making things worse. Companies that make these chips may be reluctant to invest in new factories because the chip carry thin profit margins, and the industry is notoriously cyclical, with spikes in demand followed by sharp declines. They fear a future glut of chips that would drive prices lower. If you look at the history of the semiconductor industry, there are surges in profitability and price followed by spectacular down cycles. What we just don't know is whether this ongoing growth in demand will continue. There's a lot of new chip-making capacity in the works, but most of it will go to leading-edge chips. Gartner issued a report in January that predicts chip makers will invest $146 billion in new capacity this year, up 50% from 2019, but only a small share will be for older, more commonly used chips. In theory, Adding more capacity for leading-edge chips should free up some companies to make older components, but not when demand outpaces supply. Companies have recently begun investing in new capacity for older chips, but only after requiring customers to commit to 2 years or more of orders. The strain placed on these components and on the supply chain that makes them is evident from the way problems like water shortages in Taiwan and extreme weather in Texas have impacted production. There just isn't any room, a couple weeks of inventory to absorb any of these impacts. We talk about COVID as if it was in the past, but COVID is not in the past from a supply chain reality. And the reality is that shortages in the chip industry are not transitory. There's a dirty little secret. Carbon emissions in the global chip industry. Vast amounts of energy are required to manufacture the chips that lie beneath the hood of a whole manner of items, from fighter jets and cars to kettles and doorbells. A team of researchers at Harvard University wrote that chip manufacturing accounts for most of the carbon output from electronic devices. While some of this energy comes from renewable sources, much of it comes from fossil fuels like coal and gas, and some chip makers now emit more carbon than well-known car makers. Several aspects of semiconductor production process require vast amounts of power. To begin with, the chip makers need to take raw silicon, that is to say, sand, melt it down, purify it, and then grow the silicon rods. The furnaces needed to do this are extremely energy hungry. The rods of purified silicon are then sliced like deli meat into thin wafers upon which chips are built. Various materials are layered onto the wafers in a series of steps that use energy-intensive equipment. The fusion furnaces, ion implanters, and plasma etching machines all need considerable amounts of power. Some require very high temperatures. The diffusion furnaces, for example, run at 1200 to 2000 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wafers sit in them for hours at a time to change the surface characteristics of the silicon. Most of the world's chips are made in Asia, with Taiwan being a particular hotbed of activity thanks to the presence of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which produces more chips than any other company worldwide. A Greenpeace researcher in Taiwan, who leads the charity climate corporate team, said Taiwan Semiconductor emits more carbon than any other chip maker. It's way ahead of others. The Hsinchu headquarter firm, which makes chips for the likes of Apple and Tesla, uses more electricity each year than Taiwan's capital Taipei, according to Greenpeace. As a result of its power consumption, Taiwan Semiconductor emitted 6 million tons of carbon in 2017, 8 million tons in 2019, and 15 million in 2020. In the last couple of years, Taiwan Semiconductor greenhouse gas emissions have overtaken those of automotive giant General Motors, according to data from Bloomberg. Gartner said it's important to compare the semiconductor industry's emissions to emissions for other industries such as logistics, aviation, and shipping. Taiwan Semiconductor emissions, which are shared in its annual sustainability reports, are still increasing rapidly due to constant expansion. Indeed, Taiwan Semiconductor is in the process of setting up huge new factories in Taiwan and Arizona. While these multi-billion dollar facilities will increase the supply of chips, they will also increase the amount of electricity that Taiwan Semiconductor uses. In order to reduce carbon emissions, switching the electricity sources to clean energy is the key. The chip makers are eager to do this as soon as possible. After Taiwan Semiconductor, Samsung and Intel have the next biggest carbon footprints in the semiconductor industry. As with most industries, carbon footprint is impacted by business size. Emissions will scale with size and number of fabs, so the bigger the semi vendor, the larger its carbon footprint will be. The heavyweights of the industry said they are taking actions to try to ensure they reduce their emissions as they scale up their operations. The pledges come as the world looks to see what prime ministers and presidents commit to at the climate conference in Glasgow in the United Kingdom. This summer, Taiwan Semiconductor announced that it wants to reach net zero emissions by 2050. It has also set a target of reaching 40% of renewable energy used company-wide by 2030. That's not going to be easy given the makeup of Taiwan's energy mix. In 2019, 91.5% of Taiwan's primary energy was generated by fossil fuels, according to data from BP's Statistical Review of World Energy Report. Taiwan Semiconductor currently uses 4.8% of Taiwan's total power output, and the figure is set to rise to 7.2% next year, according to Greenpeace. Taiwan Semiconductor deputy spokesperson said that the company plans to purchase more renewable energy and carbon credits. It is also looking to improve the efficiency of the equipment in its factories and implement more energy conservation projects. In July of last year, Taiwan Semiconductor signed a 20-year deal with Ørsted to buy the entire production of two offshore wind farms under development off Taiwan's west coast. Samsung's chip plants emitted 12.9 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalents in 2020, making it the second biggest carbon emitter in the semiconductor industry. A spokesperson for the company said, "Samsung is constantly evaluating the environment impact of greenhouse gas emissions across the entire manufacturing cycle," adding that the business is optimizing process technologies and materials as part of an effort to create its chips in an eco-friendly way. Samsung has not formally announced its own net zero target, but the firm is a critical part of South Korea's vision to become carbon neutral by 2050. Rival Intel has been praised for cutting its carbon emissions in recent years. In 2020, the company produced 2.88 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, despite consuming 10.6 billion kilowatt hours of energy worldwide. A single fab in Arizona used 561 million kilowatt hours of energy in the first 3 months of 2021. Intel said reducing the operational energy use is core to the Intel's overall climate strategy and its 2030 goals. Intel said 82% of its energy came from green sources like solar and geothermal in 2020. The Santa Clara headquartered chipmaker said it ran several projects last year that helped it to conserve 161 million kilowatt hours of energy this year. Similar projects will help it conserve an additional 125 million kilowatt hours of energy. Turning pledges into practice will be a hard part. Another challenge is that companies themselves, like Apple, could set a goal. But meeting those goals will require having the supply chain spread over multiple tiers to also get on board and create their own environmental, social, and corporate governance strategies. That's not going to be easy. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Mindy asks about printers for home versus business.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about IT and the workplace and how it impacts you. And sometimes there are things we can learn from the workplace, and this is one of the I had a question that came to me, and I'm going to answer this in a little bit of a different way. Mindy reached out, and it was a question in regards to explaining the printers for business usage versus home usage and where we go with that. Now, I'm going to answer the question because, yes, it needs addressing. But I am also a firm believer that printers are going the way of the dodo bird. The the world needed printers 20 years ago. Printers were a high value item in any workplace, in any home, and it's since dropped off. It's since gone in a really rough direction, mostly because we've stopped printing out things. I'm going to start off by saying that I used to print out a lot of information in regards to what I would deliver on the radio. I would print out a page for every time I did a segment. And that was a lot of printing. That was a lot of paper. That was a lot of toner. And I had budgeted for that, and it was perfectly fine. And I had to have a printer on hand. And if a printer broke down, and it once did, I had to rush out and I had to grab a new printer. I'm sitting in my studio right now. I have a printer that it's an office. It's a studio. It does double duty for me. I have a printer that is sitting behind me about 6 feet away on a table, and it hasn't been used in probably a month. And even then, I printed off only about 5 pages. It's nice to have. It's nice to be able to print. It's nice to be able to have something on paper at home. But the reality is, it's no longer important for me. Most of what I deal with is on my screens. It's whether we're talking about on my smartphone or on my tablet or on my desktop screens, it's all digital. And it rarely makes it over to paper because the world has shifted. Now, printers are still important in the workplace. We are moving in a direction where there's less printing happening. And I've seen this occurring over the years, and it's all going to be a matter of how fast your company makes a transition from the paper society over to the paperless society. But that was not what Mindy had asked. Mindy wanted to understand why printers for business are in a different price range, in a different whole category than home printers. And the answer is, it's a different set of usage. See, around the home, the printers that we use for home, the little desktop printers, they are compact, they're small, and they're expected to print out maybe a couple of hundred pages a month. If we're really putting them to really heavy duty usage, a couple of hundred pages a month. In the office, they have to be able to print out 100 pages, 200 pages, 300 pages, 400 pages in a day on a moment's notice. It's almost like comparing the car that you drive to and from work to the cars that are used on the Formula One circuit or on the NASCAR circuit. They are completely different. And yes, okay, there's the stock cars, and there's some allowances there, but the reality is we're still talking a different expectation on the load that's going to be put through that printer. A very distinct difference between that. A drag race. If you think about it, yeah, you could take your car on out. You could take your Toyota Camry out to the drag races. But there's going to be a number of cars out there that are going to just smoke your Toyota Camry. Just blow it out of the water. And that is what a business printer does. So there's also the amount of paper that they can hold. And there's a lot of the speed issues. But also, yes, the overall lifetime of those. They have to be able to take the abuse of high levels of printing on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, with little to no maintenance. So it's important that we make sure that these printers truly are holding up their end of the bargain, that they are absolutely solid. Do we wind up with problems here and there? Yes. That's what the IT folks are around for. That's what they do. But I hope that gives you a better idea, a better understanding of why, yes, the printer you buy for your home is going to be a couple of $100s. Okay, yeah, and the toner is going to be another $100, and the drum is going to be another $50. And why the office printer is going to be $1,500, $2,000, $5,000. And yes, there's a lot of bells and whistles that they throw in there. But yeah, it's just a matter of comparing the race cars versus your commuter car. I hope that gives you a little bit of a better understanding. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Earth has a second moon, a quasi-asteroid moon. Earth is the third planet from the sun and the subject of historical misconception for centuries. Earth was never formally discovered because it was never an unrecognized entity by humans. In ancient times, people thought the Earth was the center of the universe and that the sun, moon, planets, and stars rotated around us. Five planets had been known since ancient times: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. It wasn't until the 16th century Nicholas Copernicus established that the planets orbited the sun rather than the Earth. The first new planet discovered was Uranus. It was discovered by the English astronomer Sir William Herschel in 1781. This brought the total number of planets, including the Earth, in the solar system to seven. Neptune was discovered in 1846 and is the eighth and furthest known solar planet from the sun. In the solar system, it is the fourth largest planet by diameter, the third most massive planet, and the densest giant planet. It is 17 times the mass of Earth. The planet orbits the sun once every 164.8 years at an average distance of 2.8 billion miles. Then the object formerly known as the planet Pluto was discovered on February 18, 1930 at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, by astronomer Clyde W. Tombaugh with contributions from William H. Pickering. This brought the total up to nine in our solar system. Well, fast forward to August 2006. The International Astronomical Union, the IAU, downgraded the status of Pluto to that of dwarf planet. This means that, from now on, only the rocky worlds of the inner solar system and the gas giants of the outer system will be designated as planets. Now we had to readjust our thinking as to what constitutes a planet. Our solar system now has eight official planets. What else might the astronomers spring on us that could expand our knowledge of the cosmos? Now we're told Earth has a second moon. It is a mini-moon. It was first discovered as an asteroid in 2016 orbiting the Earth. The mystery origins of an asteroid commonly referred to as Earth's second moon have finally been revealed according to a new study in the publication Nature. We may at last know how it was formed. The quasi-moon, known as Kamaʻoʻeliwa, was discovered by scientists at the University of Hawaii in 2016 and takes its name from Hawaiian chants, alluding to an offspring that travels on its own. The quasi-moon named Kamaʻoʻeliwa, after a Hawaiian word that refers to a moving celestial object, is not much to speak of, measuring less than 164 feet across. It circles the Earth in a repeating corkscrew trajectory that brings it no closer than 40 to 100 times the 239,000 miles distance of our more familiar moon. Its odd flight path is caused by the competing gravitational pulls of the Earth and the Sun, which continually bend and torque moonlet's motions, preventing it from achieving a more conventional orbit. Astronomers have named the mini-moon for now 2020 CD3. It's primarily influenced just by the Sun's gravity, but this pattern shows up because it's also, but not quite, on an Earth-like orbit. So it's this sort of odd dance, says graduate student Ben Sharkey of the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona, the lead author of the paper. None of this means that Kamaʻoʻeliwa has to have especially exotic origins. The solar system is littered with asteroids, some of which are captured by the gravity of other planets and become more conventional, if fragmentary, moons. Others don't orbit other planets in the common way, but fall into line in front of them or behind them and pace them in their orbits around the sun, like the flocks of so-called Phrygian asteroids that precede and trail Jupiter. Either way, Kama Oaliwa was bound to get attention because its composition posed a stubborn mystery. Asteroids tend to reflect brightly in certain infrared frequencies. Kama Oaliwa just doesn't. It's dimmer somehow, clearly made of different stuff, which suggests a different origin. To investigate the mystery, Sharkey, under the guidance of his PhD advisor, planetary scientist Vishnu Reddy, turned to a NASA-run telescope in Hawaii routinely used for studying Earth-vicinity asteroids. But even through the usually reliable instrument, the infrared signatures seemed too faint. Instead, they switched to a University of Arizona-run monocular telescope that, as Sharkey says, could squeeze every last ounce of photons out of that object. That produced better, clearer results, but still they were incomplete. The rock was made of common silicates like other asteroids, but they were common only in their general composition, not in their infrared signature, which remained stubbornly off. At last, the answer suggested itself. If Kama Oaliwa was behaving like a sort of quasi-moon, perhaps it was an artifact of the actual moon. Earlier in Sharkey's PhD program, one of his advisors published a paper on lunar samples brought back by the Apollo 14 mission in 1971. When Sharkey compared the data he was getting in his telescopes with what the earlier geologists came up with in the rock lab, the results matched perfectly. The kind of space weathering lunar silicate undergo when they're still on the surface on the moon precisely accounted for the differences in the infrared reflectivity between common asteroids and Kama Oaliwa. Visually, what you're seeing is weathered silicate, says Sharkey. The eons of exposure to space environment and the micrometeorite impacts. It's almost like a fingerprint and it's hard to miss. How Kama Oaliwa shook free of our lunar companion is no mystery. The moon's been getting bombarded by space rocks for billions of years, resulting in all manner of lunar debris getting ejected into space, nearly 500 bits of which have made it to the surface of the Earth as meteorites. Kama Oaliwa was one such piece of lunar rubble that spiraled away from the moon, but rather than landing on Earth or simply tumbling off into the void, it found itself a quasi-satellite in its own right. We see thousands of craters on the moon, so some of this lunar ejection has to be sticking around in space. Kama Oaliwa won't stick around all that long as its current trajectory is not entirely stable. According to estimates from Sharkey and others, the object will remain an earthly companion for only about 300 more years, nothing at all on the cosmic clock, which after it will break free of its current gravitational chains and twirl off into the void. Originally a part of the moon, then a companion of Earth, it will spend the rest of its long life traveling on its own. Kama Oaliwa's odd flight path is caused by the competing gravitational pulls of the Earth and the Sun, which bends the asteroid's motions. Due to its orbit, Kama Oaliwa can only be observed from Earth for a few weeks every April. Its relatively small size means it can only be seen with one of the largest telescopes on Earth, only adding to its mystery. It's primarily influenced just by the Sun's gravity, but this pattern shows up because it also, but not quite, on Earth-like orbit, so it's this sort of odd dance. While asteroids are far from uncommon in the great void above, Kama Oaliwa is different in its appearance. It's unclear how it may have broken loose. That's because there are no other known asteroids that have lunar origins. The final piece of the puzzle was found in April this year. This spring, we got much-needed follow-up observations and went, wow, it is real. It is easier to explain with the moon than other ideas. Kama Oaliwa's unstable orbit provides another clue to its lunar origins because it's not typical of other near-Earth asteroids. It is very unlikely that a garden-variety near-Earth asteroid would spontaneously move into a quasi-satellite orbit, and it would not remain in this particular orbit for very long, only about 300 years in the future. And it is estimated that it arrived in this orbit about 500 years ago. After that, the moon rock will spend the rest of its life traveling alone through space. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Calling out cryptocurrency.
Marty Winston's been out and about on various little excursions, as we've been talking about here and there. But I did get a chance to wrangle a man. I've got him here. Marty, tell me about crypto.
Oh, crypto. Yes, crypto. I'm wonderful. It was Superboy's dog from the planet Krypton. He had superpowers. He could fly. He could see in color, unlike other dogs. And he never needed to be walked.
That joke is kind of rough. I'm just barking up the wrong tree with this.
I just know it, yeah.
What was that?
They're going to shut us down for that.
I'm just barking up the wrong tree. Yes. Anyway, so cryptocurrency, a.k.a. Bitcoin and
fake money.
Yeah. Truly fake money.
Cryptocurrency. Remember in high school, all the girls who promised you if you bought them such and such, they go out with you and they never would? Cryptocurrency is like that.
Oh, my. Yeah.
You know, let's not talk about non-fungible tokens.
Yeah.
What is not that? It's something you can't return at Christmas, right? I mean, frangible usually means you can break it up. You know, frangible tape comes apart, so you can never get the whole sticker off. It's a security measure. Mm-hmm. So, really, non-frangible tokens means the token is stuck together. You can't pull it apart. Well, what's a token? A token is something that stands for something else and really isn't it. Have you ever looked at a dollar bill? What do you think it is? It's a promise from the government to give you that value, whatever it happens to be at that minute.
Yeah, it used to be silver. It used to be silver certificates, gold certificates. Now it's In God We Trust. Yes, it is.
Even most grandparents out there don't remember that stuff. You know, really, how old are you, Ben?
No, they were still
Federal Reserve notes. Federal Reserve notes is more current.
And
then there were savings bonds.
Yeah, savings bonds still exist, don't they? I don't know.
They're a terrible investment.
These days, a lot of things are terrible investments. So, you know,
more money investing in forever stamps.
Yeah, earlier this year, Bitcoin went from whatever it was to half of what it was worth in weeks.
What are you going to do? I think it's time to escalate the thing and let us come out with our own Bitcoin.
That's a computer joke. We'll explain that another time.
A byte is 8 bits, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
A quarter is 2 bits, so a byte is a buck. Got the math, folks? Got the math.
There you go. Yeah.
No, how many bitcoins do I own? Let me ask you this. How many DeLoreans do I own?
Well, you sold one. You sold one to that crazy doctor who's still making a time machine. No, I'm kidding.
I didn't sell it. He took it.
He ran off with it and some plutonium. So I struggle with Bitcoin. You know, I struggled with it. I almost bought $100 of it on a lark back when it was a dollar. I know somebody else who did buy $100 or so when it was about $2. He's the only person I know who's really bought into Bitcoin heavily. He lucked out. He's retired now. He fully retired, and his wife and him are – they moved to Arizona. They moved hot area of all of Arizona's hot, but yeah.
go to any sink. You got 2 taps. One is hot water, the other is steam.
Yeah. Hot and hotter.
Let's deal with this in a way that is relatable to people.
Sure, yeah.
A Bitcoin where the guys who are in early make money, isn't that a characteristic of a pyramid scheme?
where the first people in make a bunch of money, and everybody who comes along later makes less money. Yes, that's a pyramid scheme.
That risk and can get stung and lose it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what happens when the – let's pretend we're writing a script.
Mm-hmm.
And in that script, somebody decides they want to make off with the fortune in bitcoins on the server they own. And they do that by pretending to have been hacked. All of a sudden, I couldn't do anything about it. They were in before I knew it. They hacked my server, and it had a backdoor to all the other servers on the non-fungible token network. And now I'm sorry, everyone who bought this Bitcoin has nothing left. Well, that guy's collected, what, $1 trillion right there?
Yeah, and there have been a few of the cases like that. There were, I think it's about 1% of the cryptocurrencies went belly up due to suspected or outright known fraud. Another 10% have failed just because they were just bad ideas.
So let's focus on the key question here.
Yes.
People, should you invest in Bitcoin? And the answer is, if you have more money than brains and want to adjust the ratio, by all means, do it.
Who was it? I think it was Elon Musk at one point. No, maybe it was him. After investing in Bitcoin, said, you know, anybody who invests in it is stupid, which was really bizarre that, you know, he would do that. But, hey, yeah, it's an ongoing saga. I think
where he sends his cars.
Into space. I know, yeah.
With some dummy at the wheel.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has canceled their November meeting because it's Thanksgiving Day. And if you want more information, their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, December the 2nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, December the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is Lightning Talks. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.